This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.
With us on the line now is Timandra Harkness. She's a broadcaster, statistician, and a mathematician who came to science through comedy. Her latest book, Technology is Not the Problem, is the ultimate history of our relationship with technology and how it shapes our world and our lives today, from smartphones to AI. Welcome to the show, Timandra.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, perfect. Thanks for joining us. So, well, I'm interested to hear about your background coming to science from comedy. That sounds great.
Yeah, it's slightly the other way around from most of the people I know. I started out in performance. I kind of fell into doing circus and from that into comedy. And then I refound an interest in science and mathematics that I'd had at school. So I started doing comedy shows about science and mathematics. And so that was slightly the opposite. So I was working with a lot of people who started out working as scientists and then developed their communication and performance skills. But I was kind of coming the other way, just going, oh, this is all really interesting. I got bored with doing comedy about cats and dogs and the differences between men and women. And here there's a whole load of great science stuff to do comedy about.
Oh, I love that. That's brilliant. So it's possible to make science and maths funny then?
Well, of course, it's very fashionable now. Certainly in the UK, there's a lot of people doing it. But I was doing comedy on the circuit, and then I was also doing bits of journalism. And at a science meeting at the Royal Society, which is very prestigious, in the tea room, I bumped into somebody I knew from the comedy circuit, Helen Pilcher. And I was like, well, what are you doing here? And she said, well, my day job is I'm an experimental scientist. I'm a neuroscientist. What are you doing here? And so we started the UK's first comedy science double act. But of course, everybody's at it now. But I like to say we were the first. Not maybe the best, but definitely the first.
Oh, love it. So why did you decide to look into the subject of technology and looking at technology through history and how it's affected us so much?
Well, I wrote a book that came out first in 2016 about big data, called Big Data, Does Size Matter? And that was a very general look at a topic that at that point, lots of people were talking about. It had just kind of hit public consciousness. But a lot of people, in fact, my stepmother said something so wonderful. I put it in the introduction. She said, is this book for people like me who keep hearing the word big data and don't really know what it means? And want to be able to discuss it intelligently at dinner parties. And I said, yes, that's exactly it. So it's for a general audience. And then this book, I thought I was just going to write about the technology that personalizes everything for us. So the way that each of us gets our own individual channel for news and entertainment, or, I mean, obviously personalized adverts, we're used to that, but all the services and the apps we get personalize things just for us. But the more I looked into the technology, the more I thought, actually, I'm interested in a different question. I'm interested in why we have this technology and not different technology. What is it about us that makes us so keen to have everything personalized to us and we don't want to be the same as everybody else? And so that's why it ended up being so much history and sociology and even philosophy, because I ended up saying, well, actually, I think this is why it's called Technology is Not the Problem, because I think really the problem is us and our obsession with having ourselves reflected back to ourselves all the time.
Yeah, because you think that we'd be, as humans, much more wary of technology because of all the problems with privacy, the data gathering, all that kind of stuff that goes on. You think a lot more, many more people would kind of go, nope, that's it. I'm getting rid of my mobile. I'm switching off my computer. But we're spending more and more time online as opposed to going off it.
Yeah, exactly. And that was what kind of intrigued me, because whereas when I wrote the first book, people weren't that aware. And when I would say to people, oh, you know that when you do this, it just gathers all your data, people were genuinely surprised and a bit shocked. But when I started writing this book, I thought, people know this now. We might not know the details, but we know that everything we do digitally puts data out there about us, and this is collected and used to profile us. So exactly. It's like, what is it that keeps us going back? Even though, you know, we do, and I'm the same. I say, well, it's creepy and invasive and I don't like it. But in another way, I do like it, because on some level, I feel that I'm unique and special, and therefore I deserve to have unique, special digital world that's tailored just for me. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why I ended up saying, look, you know, we could get rid of all the technology. You could go, I'm going to chuck my smartphone in the sea and go back to writing letters. But the root of the problem really is us and our insecurity about who we are that wants this kind of personalization.
Yeah. I mean, people are doing kind of less silly quizzes online, those ones on Facebook that tell you, you know, what your elf name would be if you say that your mother's maiden name and your first name and your first pet's name, and then it's what your elf name would be or something random like that. Because, again, that's all data phishing, isn't it?
Yes. I do think we're much more savvy. I think we are much more aware of the dangers of giving things away. And ironically, although we kind of look at teenagers and say, oh no, it's terrible, they're so online, I think because they've grown up in that world, they are actually a bit more savvy about what it means when you give certain things away. Although I will also say that people like Facebook realized that they were essentially giving away a lot of free data to other companies by letting them do these quizzes. And so they've tightened up a bit, because they're like, well, you know, this is our audience and we want to serve them adverts. So we don't want you to know everything about our audience. We want you to pay us because we know everything about our audience. Mm.
Yeah, fascinating. So do you think there is a difference then through the generations in terms of who is more kind of tech savvy than others?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think there's a definite divide between people who've grown up with the internet and then people who've grown up with smartphones, and people like me who, I mean, I'm terribly grateful that when I was a teenager, nobody was photographing everything I got up to and putting it on social media.
Oh,
I mean,
same.
you think back and remember things you did, and think, well, thank heaven, the only people that remember that are the people that were there.
Yeah.
It does mean I've had to learn things later. Whereas I think there are people who just grow up with this and it's just normal. But I also think that there's a different expectation in terms of people reflecting your identity back to you. I think that the younger the generation, the more they see this as really important, and that if your identity is not recognized, acknowledged by others on social media, but also just generally in life, then that's felt very personally, almost as an attack. And I think that is increasing with each successive generation.
Yeah.
I mean, none of us are immune from it, but I think it is definitely getting much stronger as a social tendency.
Yeah. The problem is that, you know, not to not blame technology. So looking at social media, for example, because social media gets blamed for an awful lot, because, you know, that there has been a lot of damage caused with social media and how people take to it. But a lot of the time, if not all of the time, It all comes down to the individual. You know, it's all very well saying, well, social media is a problem, but there are lots of people that don't have a problem with social media and are able to handle the content that they're looking at, or specifically don't look at content that's going to trigger them or make them feel bad about themselves or whatever. So often it is down to how the human reacts and whether they've got a kind of support network in place, someone that they can discuss their feelings with as to how they feel when watching a certain video. You know, at the end of the day, so many of these things really does come back to the humans as opposed to the technology.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think as soon as you start saying, oh, we're helpless because the technology's in charge, then you make yourself more helpless. And also, in many cases, social media can be very positive because although it is designed to keep us going back for all these the little rewards of, oh, yes, you know, somebody liked your post or somebody's paying attention to you, it is also, it's the way that we connect with other humans. And that's a very positive thing.
Mm.
So, I mean, there's some very good research. If I might be allowed to mention somebody else's book, there's a psychology professor called Pete Etchells, who has a new book out called Unlocked, where he looks at the research into screen time for adults and especially for young people, and says, you know, it's not one picture. It can be negative, but it can also be very positive, depending, as you say, on the context and the person and what they're using it for. So I think it's a mistake to throw all the technology out, but we should be a bit more deliberate about how we use it. Say, well, you know, what do I want from this? What am I using it for? Am I just picking it up because I don't want to have to decide what to do next?
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that's the thing that I constantly do. It's like, I don't want to decide what to do next. So I know I'll look at my phone and then half an hour's gone.
Yeah. It's too easy, isn't it?
It is too easy. But you know, that's down to me. That's down to me to go, no, you're doing this again. Go and actually just walk downstairs, put the kettle on, have a little think about what you need to do next. So stay in control.
It is. It's absolutely true. It is our choice. You know, in those moments, you could go for a walk, you could read a book, you could put the television on, you could put the radio on, you could listen to a podcast. There's a million things that you could do, but you're choosing to go onto your phone. You know, that's the point, isn't it? So can we blame the phones?
Well, no, exactly. I mean, it's, yeah, they're designed to be attractive, but this is why I ended up looking at, you know, what is it in us that's attracted to that? And I do think a lot of it comes down to this constant need for affirmation that, you know, we are unique and special and somebody is paying attention to us.
Yeah. So what about AI? I mean, it's a massive subject, obviously, but how do you feel about that and the advancements that are happening on what seems like a daily basis?
I'm a little bit worried that all the attention to things like ChatGPT-4 and the large language models that generate things, generative AI, is going to lead to disillusionment because they give the illusion of being almost human and sentient because they interact with us using our own language. But actually, you know, they're quite limited in many ways. They have no conception of what's true or of the real world in any way. Whereas I think there's actually other kinds of AI that are doing tremendous things, the slightly more old-fashioned kinds of AI that can just do calculations really quickly or machine learning that can spot patterns in things like, you know, like examining brain scans and so on. So I actually think it's like, well, you know, maybe we're too impressed with one kind of AI and not impressed enough with the other kind. And I worry that disillusionment will set in and that will affect the more useful kinds of AI. But again, it's partly projection, I think, that we project onto it human-like capabilities because we have a slightly diminished sense of our own capabilities. And so we go, oh, well, look, this AI, I don't understand it, so it must be terribly clever. So it's probably cleverer than me. And so I'm going to let it make decisions for me. And that's where I want to say, no, you must never let it make decisions.
Yeah.
Let it stick to what it's good at.
Yeah. Yeah. The biggest worry for me, I think, and just society in general is it taking over, you know, taking jobs away from humans, particularly in the creative sense, you know, writers, journalists, songwriters. But then in the voice sense, singers, radio presenters, podcasters.
Well, yeah.
You know, if it's got the skills to write and it's got the skills to talk and sing, models as well. They're doing the first AI Miss World contest. You know, what are humans going to be left for?
And it is annoying, isn't it? You think, but we want humans to do the creative thing.
Yes.
And the AI to do the boring routine stuff. This
exactly.
is the wrong way around.
Come and clean the house.
Yeah, exactly. Although, ironically, I think those jobs are much harder for AI than... But no, I do share that worry. But again, it's down to us, really. If we're satisfied with things that are just basically shiny pastiches of things that humans have previously produced, then that's what we'll get. But I'd like to think that we will soon start to see that this all looks and sounds pretty much the same. And if you want originality and new thinking, then you do need humans.
Yeah.
But as you were saying before about the other kinds of technology, it's only going to take over if we decide to leave the field and let it take over. It's not actively trying to take over our lives. It's only if we step aside, then it will come in and take our places.
Yeah, but it's the humans behind it that are making all the money that are going to want to to push it.
Yes.
That's the issue, isn't it? It's the money makers, the powerful people that are going, yes, let's let it take over, then we'll earn a fortune.
That's right. We won't have to pay humans to do this.
Yes.
We can just rake in all the money from
Absolutely.
The people licensing our software.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, it's a fascinating subject. Thank you for coming on the show, Timandra Harkness. If listeners want to get a copy of the book, Technology is Not the Problem, it's available on our website, TRE.radio. Timandra, thanks so much for being with us.
Lovely talking to you. Thank you.